Information on the series, The Mystery of Jane Roberts and Seth. And it's a fascinating experience. It certainly has been fascinating for me. I've spent many years involved with this mystery, trying to understand it, trying to unravel the intricate messages that Seth had offered. I think it would be worthwhile to do a little review from last week's show. And I think basically, in terms of the review, it amounts to understanding that Jane Roberts is a very much misunderstood person. The modern day mystics want to say things like, well, why didn't she use Seth to cure her own problems, da-da-da-da-da. And of course, that never was the point. And Jane herself would tell you, she was never all that convinced. All she had was a voice in her head. And I think some of the people that reviewed the material, especially Sue Watkins' book, Jane's very close friend, really also missed the point. They would say things like, well, why didn't she just put in a regimentation of all the things that Seth had to offer? Well, you know, folks, that's exactly what kind of goes on today on the net. It seems like every day there's a new, fashionable, organized bit of spirituality that people want to jump on the bandwagon. That's not the way to approach life. Do life on your terms. That's called creating your own reality. Create the reality of someone else. Can you use some of the concepts? Absolutely. Of course, incorporate the concepts. Don't get obsessive with it.
I can barely hear it.
Well, the Seth material kind of begins with a Ouija board. Yeah. That's how it all started, with the Ouija board. And that is December 3rd, 1963.
People speak with host of politics, activism, spirituality,
literature,
science,
Bill.
And other social issues.
Hold on,
folks. I just heard myself say I can barely hear it.
Oh. I had a little interruption there, folks. It was my wife talking. She's kind of monitoring this for me. You know, when you're on the radio alone, you really have no way of knowing what's going on. And so I kind of have to keep Jill on the side with a set of headphones on, seeing if she can hear what's going on. That's how I know whether or not I'm on the air. Anyway, where were we? Ouija board. That's where it begins, in late 1963. It's December 3rd. And we have two people wanting to do a little bit of metaphysical experiment. And that's all that it amounts to. Hold on one second, folks. I got to find out if it's loud enough.
Loud enough, but there's still something in the background.
Oh, well, if Don is listening, Jill informs me that there's some kind of background noise coming through. Don, I don't know if you can hear that or not. I'm not really sure what it is. Anyway, I'm just going to continue on as if everything is perfect. Of course, I live in a perfect world. I create my own reality. So we are into the Ouija board, and Jane and her husband, Robert, decide to sit down one night and see if they can do something with a Ouija board. That's how this whole thing began. Jane was doing research for a book originally on extrasensory perception, and she kept digging, and eventually, you know, she got kind of interested in the whole metaphysical aspect of the universe. And so she picked on something she knew, you know, a Buzz Brothers Ouija board. So now we have to take a little side trip. Yeah, because we have to discuss Ouija boards. I can't really get into Jane Roberts until we get this little thing out of the way. First of all, what is a Ouija board? Well, most of you would have some sort of idea that it's a board with a whole bunch of letters on it, the letters of the alphabet, and a yes and a no, and maybe a couple of other questions. But there's a lot of controversy among metaphysical people about the use of a Ouija board, which I personally find, how can I say this discreetly, I find it silly. There's nothing to be afraid of. The only thing that will happen to you is that which you expect. That's right. Now, there are several theories about the origin of the term Ouija, and it is believed that it comes out of the French term oui, for yes, and the German Dutch for ja, which is also yes. It's really not known exactly how all this came about, but there seems to be a lot of mystery around Ouija boards. And there are claims, for instance, that it comes out of ancient Egypt and connected to an ancient Egyptian word meaning good luck. Well, it is a registered trademark. By the way, at one time the trademark was Ouija board, now it's just Ouija. Some people claim that it came out of China around 1200 BC, some sort of divination method known as Fuji or something similar to that. Other sources claim that there's a French historical account of a philosopher in 540 BC, and his sect would conduct seances at a mystic table moving on wheels, and it moved towards signs. Well, there really is no evidence of any of this. I mean, I've done a lot of research, and my conclusion? They're all full of horse feathers. They really are. How they make a connection between a table moving around the floor and a modern-day Ouija board is beyond me. But essentially, what you can find out is that the actual use of a board such as this comes out of the spiritualism movement in the United States, which was probably around the mid-19th century. Well, let's say 1850, 1860, somewhere in there, just prior to the Civil War. And beyond that, there really isn't much else in terms of where it comes from. Frankly, it was a damn good idea. I wish I had the patent on it. And today, of course, the Parker Brothers do hold, or the Parker Brothers Corporation did hold the patent on it. I don't know if that is still true in the year 2007. I'm really not sure. I know that it was the entire business was sold to the Parker Brothers around 1966, and all the trademarks and everything else went along with it. Anyway. So what is a Ouija board? Can the Ouija board harm or kill someone? Hell no. It's a board. It's a board with letters on it. Now, who's going to disagree with me? Well, here they come marching again. The Christians and all their fears. They love fearful stuff, folks. They really do. Let's be afraid of this. Let's be afraid of that. Can it create depression or suicidal thoughts? No, it can't do anything. But the person using it, if you're a sick dude to begin with, and you believe in the Christian point of view, you know, kind of like the old voodoo crap, it's going to happen. Yeah, because you make it happen. In other words, if you're screwed up to begin with, the belief in the Ouija board being able to harm you is really going to make you screwed up. What I'm telling you, it's your expectation that leads to the outcome. That really shouldn't be too hard to understand. A lot of Christians, and you'll find this on the net, actually all over the net, they like to refer to the spirits are experts in seduction. They're referring to the spirits that come through the Ouija board are imitating what you think are spirit guides or spirit of dead loved ones, angels, so on and so forth. And what they claim is that these are really all evil spirits, and they put such a spin on things that they can twist the truth with lies, so to speak. Well, they think these spirits are just waiting for a chance to possess anyone who will have them. What a bunch of hogwash. I've used the Ouija board plenty of times. I've played with it. I don't feel particularly possessed. I have seen some rather amazing things occur on a Ouija board. And I have seen some negative things come out of a Ouija board. But, I feel pretty good. Why am I saying this? Because what I'm trying to get across to you is that it is your expectation that's going to lead to the outcome. And if you're not wrapped very tight to begin with, I certainly wouldn't advise using a Ouija board. If you're not wrapped too tight to begin with, I wouldn't even suggest you listen to this program. It's all about the individual. Can you, in fact, get dangerous spirits? Well, I don't know about dangerous spirits, but they certainly can be nasty in terms of having a real potty mouth. I've seen that happen on a Ouija board. And what I did at that point is I just simply said, okay, let's stop it. We got a turkey here. And that was the end of it. Nobody went up in flames. The board didn't shoot up in the air. No, that did not happen. Now, my most recent experience with a Ouija board, Joe and I did this, I think it was 2 years back. I made a Ouija board. We were fooling around. And I said, okay, let's make a Ouija board. I did. Unfortunately, we couldn't get anything out of the damn thing. I don't know what happened, but we played around with it for a few weeks. And, we got a little bit. But, nothing really significant. There's a recent movie, a couple years old, I guess, called White Noise. Hollywood takes a lot of liberty with these kinds of events. The upshot of the movie was that if you play with EVP, that you're going to wind up somehow screwed up. Now, EVP is the electronic voice phenomenon. And a lot of you are aware of it. You hear about people going out to graveyards with recorders and recording different sounds and so on and so forth. Some of them actually get speech. Well, the movie tries to make the argument that EVP is really dangerous. You shouldn't be doing it. More fear. Oh, what a bunch of crap. That's all that it is. People who have been working with electronic equipment have been listening to EVP types of stuff for years and years. And unfortunately or unfortunately, no one has yet gone, crazy from some entity reaching out to choke them to death. Although, if you had to sit in front of a screen listening to electronic static all day, it probably would make you a little nuts. What am I telling you? I took this little sidebar simply to say that Jane and her husband, Robert, according to my opinion, were doing nothing more than using what they knew. And no, I did not see this any more dangerous than anything else I do on this planet. So, where does that leave us with Jane and Robert? Well, you gotta get this picture in your mind. We're talking about two people on a cold, wintry type night in Elmira, New York, and they got this Ouija board between them, and all of a sudden, they begin to receive coherent messages from a male personality who eventually identifies himself as Seth. And there's a lot of clarification is needed in terms of the name. accept states, that it's just a handle he used, and that in by no stretch of the imagination would it mean that he's Seth in all cases and all dimensions and so on and so forth. But this male personality did come through. Now, it wasn't too long after their first few sessions that Jane tells Robert she was hearing the messages in her head. In other words, she was saying, I really don't need the Ouija board, because I can hear the message as we ask the questions. Wow. So now, they give up the Ouija board. Now, the modern-day fearful person, whether it's a Christian or from one of the rank and file of organized spirituality, would say, oh, well, she's now possessed. Oh, bullshit. No, she's not possessed. She was hearing a voice, period, the end. Now, for 21 years until Jane's death in 1984, Jane held regular sessions in which she went into a trance and spoke on behalf of the discarnate entity that we call Seth. Wow. I mean, can you imagine she did this for 21 years? By the way, all the sessions were recorded. Her husband, Robert, was a faithful stenographer, and he would take the messages down in his own sort of homemade shorthand. There were some sessions were recorded, but for some reason, and I do not know why, I can't find an answer to it, Robert did not like to use a recording device. And the messages from the Seth personality, they were mainly monologues on a wide variety of topics, and it's collectively known as the Seth material. Well, Jane, of course, at the front end of all this, Jane and Robert, their primary questions were about themselves at a personal level. You know, they were asking questions about them personally. They started to realize that the messenger had much, much to say, and so they started asking questions in a more general sense. Questions on, I don't know, the essence of mankind, philosophical issues. And then they even went into historical issues, like who was the man Jesus, and so on and so forth. Seth responded to all of this. And we will cover it piece by piece. If I had to put one category for all the Seth material and say, what is the bottom line? What is the bottom line of all this material? It is, you create your own reality. Another way of saying that, too, is you get what you expect. Now, the material through 1969 was published in a summary form in the Seth material. And that was written by Jane with some excerpts from Seth himself. However, beginning about 1970, actually I think it was right in January of 1970, Seth, on his own, says to Jane, I want to dictate my own book. So you see, now prior to this, they were simply mainly asking questions, usually of a personal nature, some philosophical, but mainly personal. On the 511th session in 1970, Seth all of a sudden says he wants to dictate a book. Wow. So, when Jane put it together, she claimed actually no authorship of these books. The only thing that she would admit to is she was a medium. But that everything in those books was channeled, and it's published verbatim. Well, the entire series totaled about 10 volumes, and because of Jane's illness, the last two were incomplete. The very first one or at least I think it's the first one. At least it's the first one that seems to be, if you go by the edition page, is Seth Speaks, which really puts into a nutshell the entire concept of creating your own reality. But there are a list of other books, too, such as The Nature of Personal Reality, The Nature of the Psyche, The Individual, and The Nature of Mass Events. By the way, that's an extremely interesting book. I read that one a few times, and it's not as popular as Seth Speaks. But I'll tell you what, I consider it one of the better books of all of them written. It really is good, because it kind of gives you a view of mankind as a social animal. So, who is Seth? Well, as I said, he's an entity channeled by Jane, but he describes himself simply as an energy personality essence no longer focused in physical reality. That's how he describes himself. He and Jane claim that he is independent of Jane's subconscious. Although, I can't get an answer to this one, Jane was skeptical as to Seth's origins. There's not a whole lot written about that. But she was skeptical about his origins. Now, for you organized spiritual people out there, please don't jump on a bandwagon and say, aha, really the devil in disguise. No. She's simply saying that it was very difficult to begin with to try to convey the messages that she was being given. You know, she had to reinterpret everything that he said through her own brain and come out of her mouth. And she had a tough time understanding Seth's origin. He did insist that he had at one time completed his earthly reincarnations. Now, that's plural, reincarnations. And he was finished with it. And he was speaking from a dimension, some system of reality that is kind of close to ours, or he would describe it as parallel, adjacent to. And he definitely described himself as an educator. Now, this is where it gets a little bit sticky. Why is he? You have to start asking yourself the question, why is he an educator? How does he take on the task? Well, the task itself was to, according to him, supply the current generation of human beings with the material that he decided to present to Jane in the cul-de-sac material. And as you start reading about Seth, you come to find out that, at least what Seth believes, is that existence itself is not something that is at all random. It is certainly not chaotic. And that you simply do not go from one form of existence to another form of existence simply because you want to. In other words, there is a system of sorts. Now, what holds that system together, how it works, I mean, you know, you can come up with all kinds of strange concepts, like some sort of committee sitting around somewhere in the astral plane deciding, you know, should the human species move on, should this person move on, so on and so forth. I don't know how it works. Jane didn't, and Seth did not describe in any kind of detail how that entire system of existence worked. In other words, who set the standard? Where does the standard come from in terms of what reality you can go to, or I should say, what universe or dimension you can go to? Well, there's a very good reason for it. I I'll get to that. I understand the reason quite well, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. The problem that I have is it's hard understanding how the organization came about. You know, I mean, who sets the standard? And it becomes kind of a circle, because if we are all part of that one thing, then we set the standard at some level. We all seem to be able to do that, even though we might be at the very lower echelon of realities, so to speak. And even Seth will say that this dimension, the earth plane, the third dimension, what he calls the material dimension, is kind of like preschool. Yeah, we're way, way, way down at the bottom. And there's a very good reason for it. We are just now learning how to deal with the concept, create your own reality. Think of it this way. What if everybody on the planet tomorrow morning would wake up and could create their own reality instantaneously? Now, this is a tough question. If whatever they did affected only them, no problemo, right? But what about the screwball that wakes up in the morning and decides, oh, I want to liquidate my neighbors? Can you imagine the chaos? What Seth tells us is that what we are doing in this dimension is learning how to deal with the very foundations of material and creating our own reality. It's pretty clear. We don't have the universal ethics or morality to actually be able to just do this right now in any style we want. We are limited by doing it in this particular dimension. So we're just starting out. Well, one of the things that was noted by a lot of people who attended the sessions that Jane held was that Seth's personality and his demeanor was very different than Jane. He had a sense of humor. He could be harsh, he could be stern. And he did apparently have a distinct accent, but nobody seems to be able to identify what the accent was. Now, there is a comparison made between Jane and Edgar Cayce when they're speaking. Edgar Cayce spoke in a trance. And the words and sentences he used were considered very antiquated and somewhat convoluted. And Jane's syntax and sentence structures, they were modern and clear when speaking to Seth. Now, this brings me to something that I've been wanting to talk about. You ever notice that some of the stuff you read about these so-called channels is really all this convoluted, antiquated language and calling you dear and loved one and so on and so forth? You know, it makes me suspicious, folks. It makes me very suspicious. It really does. Jane spoke in the syntax and sentence structure she knew because she was channeling it. She wasn't creating it. She was simply passing the message from her brain through her syntax structure. So, of course, she spoke in a modern, clear tongue. Now, they held sessions usually twice a week. And she had this... Jane held the sessions with a number of people around, and many people were invited. The one thing that Jane did not do is, or very little of, is she did not give readings to the public. She had a couple of ESP classes, a couple of channeling session classes, but there was very little readings to the general public like you might find today. Very, very little. And it may simply be because Jane was actually more interested in the research aspect of what was happening to her, as opposed to, you know, becoming known as the great medium of Seth. She didn't care about that. And in fact, she doubted herself many, many times. She would tell people, listen, I'm skeptical of everything that's happening to me. I can't tell you that this is something real. Maybe it's something I created in my own brain and someone else taking me over. She was always skeptical of it. And she always constantly challenged others who wanted to nail it down. Well, the Seth material itself covers a wide variety of topics, including our physical reality, the evolution, the story of the man Jesus, who God is, what God is, the purpose of life, you know, so on and so forth. Well, let's get to some of these things that he suggested. The physical universe that we know is just one of many, many universes or systems of reality. And he says that some of them are physical in nature, some mental or spiritual. And then he goes on to say that some are so foreign in terms of what we can understand, we simply don't have the language to describe it. But that each one system is as valid as any other. Now, I'm talking about the universes of existence. We live in the physical universe, the third dimension. And he's simply saying, folks, there's a lot of universes made up of all kinds of concepts. And some of them just so difficult to describe because we simply don't have the language to describe it. Now, one of the kickers to our own universe, and I love this part, is that everything we do in the physical universe has multiple, quote, probable renditions. Now, what does that mean? Okay. Even as I'm talking to you, I have to make a choice at times of what word to use next. I can use one word, I can use another word. One word or another word. They both have a probable outcome. But only one occurs right now in this consciousness of me. But what Seth would tell you is that the other probable also occurs. And there's another Nevin who used that other probable rendition. Any event or action which is likely to occur in one probable universe, this is right out of the book, by the way, will be actualized in that or another probable universe, or will be actualized in the dream universe or in some other system of reality. In other words, if you funk it, it's going to happen. That's right. Once the thought occurs, I might not pick one word, I might give a different word, but that one that I didn't pick, it did occur. There was another system that picked it up. There was another Nevin that used that term. In other words, probable renditions are infinite. One of the examples that Seth talks about is that dinosaurs in another example of a physical universe are still alive. And he goes on to describe universes in which Christianity did not develop. By the way, you'll find much of what I'm going over now out of Wikipedia, which is a pretty darn good system if you want some quick information on something. Well, apparently each of us has a counterpart within the probable renditions of the universe. And we don't always have all the same name or the same occupation or personal relationships. But apparently there's a whole variety of Nevins out there. Some with the name Nevin, some with some other name. But there are multitudes of my personality out there, counterparts. Now, the one part that's going to be a little bit tough to understand is that Seth claims that all systems of reality are kind of a camouflage, since all beings have an existence which is independent of any system. And that's a little bit tough to understand, but what he's saying is that you as an individual existed long before the system existed. And so the system itself, the system, whichever one you happen to be involved in, kind of camouflages your own existence. The number of systems is infinite, since new systems come into existence constantly. Whoa! Think about that, folks. Constantly. I mean, how do you grasp this whole concept of infinity? And he says, no system of reality is closed or finite. They are all infinite. And if the number of systems is infinite, and new systems come into existence constantly, we have an entertainment field in front of us that is infinite. He does say that reincarnation is a rule, although he also suggests there's a lot of misconceptions about it. For instance, Seth says human beings just plain never reincarnate as animals. And there is no cause and effect between reincarnations. In other words, what you did in one reincarnation has absolutely no effect in another. And reincarnation, it doesn't end in a state of nirvana. But he does suggest that each individual must, and he says this, must experience, okay? So there's a hierarchy, or again, the system comes into play, and I don't know who's pulling the strings on it, but each individual must experience fatherhood, motherhood, and childhood, and thus must reincarnate at least twice. And again, he's using this term must. It must reincarnate at least twice. So you have to experience fatherhood and motherhood. Now, the maximum number, of course, of reincarnations can vary, and it simply depends on what each individual believes they need. And he does say that there's a time of rest between incarnations. He also suggests that sometimes individuals will occupy other planes of existence before returning to the earth. Now, I'm not really sure what that means. I do not think it means that you're crossing over from the physical type dimension to a non-physical type. I just think it means a different kind of the same thing they're typically experiencing. Now, when the individual's reincarnation is over, or the cycle is over, that is when the individual moves on to another system of reality. In other words, when my reincarnation experiences are over, when I believe I've had enough experience, then I can move out of the material system. Is there an end to this? You know, do we get to heaven or to hell? According to Seth, no. What you get is continued existence. There is no heaven or hell, at least according to Seth. There's an interesting little side trip that Seth takes when he talks about, he uses the term souls, or at least that's how it comes from Jane, that souls who are reincarnating enter the fetus shortly before, during, or after birth. Now, hold on to that. In other words, there is no soul, according to Seth, in the fetus prior to the actual birth experience. Well, this gets, you know, kind of involved in the whole abortion issue. According to Seth, the souls would be aware that abortion is going to take place and would choose not to incarnate. So if the soul enters the fetus and the fetus is then aborted, the soul continues on to other lives. According to Seth, some souls, all they want is the utero experience. They don't want to be born. Well, of course, according to Seth, there is no actual death in the universe at all. And everything reincarnates. Everything. Even the cells of the fetus will reincarnate. One of the main issues that Seth does get at in terms of creating your own reality is the difficulty we have with our ego. Well, he goes on to describe that each human individual has many layers of this ego thing which interacts with physical reality. And it kind of separates the ego into two parts, the outer ego and the inner ego. Now, the inner ego is apparently primarily concerned with maintaining the physical world of the outer ego. So the inner ego, its main concern is making sure that my physical world remains the same. Now, that can also get you into trouble because that means that the ego doesn't want to see anything change. That's what puts the stop on creating your own reality, is your own ego. The entire purpose of the ego, of the inner ego, is to maintain that physical world. Nothing changed. Nothing changes at all. It doesn't want to see anything change. Well, if it doesn't want to see anything change, how are you going to create anything new? Now, according to Seth, this inner ego did exist prior to any incarnation. So the entire self is actually a gestalt consisting of the inner self plus all the outer egos or reincarnational cells, including all probable cells in all renditions of the universe. Whoa, that's a lot. That is a lot. Now, Seth says that most humans simply are not aware of the inner ego. And that sometimes through intuition or an inner voice, some people believe they can hear this inner self. However, the inner self is aware of all reincarnational selves. So, and again, by the way, I'm getting all of this directly from Wikipedia. Now, he says that the self, or the incarnated self, actually exists simultaneously in four universes. There's the physical universe. There's the dream universe. And then he talks about an electrical universe and an antimatter universe. Well, you're not going to find a whole lot of information about those last three from Seth. The electrical, I can almost understand that one. The antimatter, that one's beyond me. That really is. Anyway, so you have four universes. You've got the physical, you've got the dream, you've got the electrical, and you have the antimatter. And Seth says that we are experiencing all of those simultaneously, all at the same time. There also does seem to be sometimes some contradictions, but again, in trying to understand it with our language, it's tough, because he says that there really are no boundaries to the self, which also means there's no boundaries to any system of reality. Also, when it comes to dreams, all portions of the self contribute to dreams, which continue when the outer ego is awake. Get that part? In other words, folks, it's another reality. The dream continues on. And I've said this before in some of the seminars I've done on creating your own reality. You know, when you go to sleep and you have a whole world open to you, whole different world with its own history, its own people, all the different characters on a stage. What happens when you wake up? What happens to all those people? What happens to that self of you? Does it all just disappear? Did it not exist? Wrong. It does exist. And it continues on when the outer ego is awake. Whoa. And I'm sure it comes as no surprise that Seth tells us that time and space itself are simply illusions. They are simply illusions. We use them as a convenience. The problem is that they became so convenient, we started to believe that they were somehow a physical part of the universe itself. Well, it's an illusion. And the reason that the way we approach time is linear is because of a limitation inherent in the physical brain. That's because of the way our brain is limited, that's how we created time accordingly to that limitation. Now, all individuals create their own circumstances and experiences within the shared earthly environment. Well, of course, what he's saying is you create your own reality, but you do it also as a group. And it was frequently used by Seth. And it may, in fact, have originated with him. I really don't know. The only time I actually ever came across it, of course, is when I started reading the Seth material. But I'm not astute enough to know, did somebody else come up with that? I don't know. Seth claims the inner self is responsible for the construction and maintenance of the individual's physical body and immediate physical environment. Events, however, unfold according to the beliefs of the ego and its attitude. So, depending on your ego, whatever your ego is, whatever its belief is, its attitude is, that's what's going to unfold. Whether it's positive or negative, it gets translated into reality. I've got to be honest with you, it seems as if the negative ones get translated into physical reality a lot easier than the positive ones. I mean, I could sit here all day and think in terms of, I don't know, a check for $100,000 showing up in the mail. Will it occur? Well, my, according to the set material, it's my doubt that stops it from occurring. But if I say I'm going to get a bill in the mail tomorrow, does it occur? Yes. Because I always get bills? No, because I believe it will. Now, I want to read to you directly from a private session given to a friend of James. And this is kind of, and the reason I'm reading this directly is because it kind of gives you, as I read it, it'll give you an idea of who the person was and what they were looking for. They had some questions, and Jane was kind enough to do a personal reading with Seth for them. Quote, "You must watch the pictures that you paint with your imagination, for you allow your imagination to full reign." Well, folks, that's what he's saying, is be careful of what you think. Quote, "If you read our early material, you will see that your environment and the conditions of your life at any given time, either it is a direct result of your own inner expectations. You form physical materializations of these realities within your own mind. If you imagine dire circumstances, ill health, or desperate loneliness, these will be automatically materialized, for these thoughts themselves bring about the conditions that will give them reality in physical terms. If you would have good health, then you must imagine this as vividly as in the fear you imagine the opposite." Now, folks, that's a real good sentence, because he's saying, with all the energy that you put into fear and imagining all the negative stuff, why don't you put all that energy, put it into the positive outcome? Quote, "You create your own difficulties. This is true for each individual. The inner psychological state is projected outward, gaining physical reality. And this, regardless of the nature of the psychological state, the rules apply to everyone. You can use them for your own benefit and change your own condition once you realize what they are. You can't escape your own attitudes, for they will form the nature of what you see." Okay, folks, what he's saying is you get what you expect. Quite literally, you see what you want to see, and you see your own thoughts and emotional attitudes materialized in physical form. If changes are to occur, they must be mental and psychic changes. These will be reflected in your environment. Negative, distrustful, fearful, or degrading attitudes towards anyone work against the self. So, what is Seth saying in that little personal reading that he gave to Jane's friend? Again, and he says, you create your own reality. Be careful of what you're imagining. Be careful of what you're thinking. Your thoughts do count. Can you control your thoughts? Well, I sure as hell can't control mine, so therefore I'm kind of thankful that I don't just immediately have this great skill of creating anything I want, because often my thoughts are in a shambles. And if I happen to be in a bad mood, what then? Can you imagine what the universe would be like if everyone was able to do that? Whatever emotion you have existing and you decide you're going to create with that, well, of course, the universe itself couldn't last, could it? I mean, it would be completely chaotic. We'd all be blowing ourselves up immediately within a nanosecond. We're children, and we're learning how to gain hold of this concept of create your own reality. There's some ethics involved here. And you have to have an ethical background. So if we're going to move on, if we're going to move forward to a different dimension, and out of this material dimension, we're going to have to learn how to create with material, but within a system of ethics and morality that benefits the entire universe and not just our own ego. Well, I am out of time. I'm going to continue on again next week with the Jane Roberts material and get a little deeper into what Seth had to say I'll also be covering some of my own material on Create Your Own Reality. Thank you for listening, and I wish you all a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don.